introduce yourself? I mean, you're the person, the legend, the developer. You've been in the company for a very long time.
it's been a very long time. My name is Larry Osterman. I am a developer. Actually, I'm the lead now of the comm team in Windows. I've been in Microsoft for almost 34 years now. And in those 34 years, I've done, practically everything. I've done networking. I've done email systems. I worked on the audio stack for many years. And for the past 8 to 10 years, I have been working on making the Windows runtime and a lot of the infrastructure and plumbing that underlies the Windows runtime.
Is it safe to say that you're probably one of the only people that still knows how Windows works in a lot of the...
Oh, no. Actually, unfortunately, there was a time when I actually could understand a lot of Windows, but that's not the case anymore because it's too large. There's too many big pieces. And there are people who do actually know most of it and almost all of it, but I'm unfortunately not one of them. I know my areas very, very well. I know some areas reasonably well. Actually, I had to go, many years ago I was asked to work on a project to generate the documentation, for protocol documentations for a component that I worked on 15 years previously. And so I said, okay, fine, I'll do the work, fine. And I went and I started, and I'm like, oh wait, I remember all this code that I wrote 15 years ago, and look, it's still there. Hasn't changed.
How do you remember that far? I look at code last year I wrote, and I have no idea what it does.
I have a very good memory.
That's amazing.
It's a thing. I'm a font of completely useless trivia.
Do you think a lot of your old code from 20, 30 years ago is still in production right now?
I know that some of the work I did in Exchange 15, 20 years ago is still in production. I don't know how much of it, but I know that some of it is still in production. And I'm not 100% sure about the stuff I did in NT3.1. One of the components I wrote was removed in 2000, but there is some code that may still be in the product. I don't know. It's long deprecated because it's been replaced by other things that are better functioning. The networking protocols stuff was dependent on have been completely and utterly deprecated. So I don't know if the code is still there or not, but I suspect it's not. Most of the stuff I worked on has sort of gone away because that's what happens is so.
Right. Well, let's talk about the stuff that you're working on right now. You mentioned the Windows runtime. You've been working on it for, 8 years?
About 8 to 10 years. Yeah. I came into the team that created the infrastructure for the Windows runtime at the ground floor when the team was first getting started. And I ended up getting heavily involved in our type system design. And basically, it's one of those things that people don't actually think about very much, but when you build a component like the Windows runtime, the common language runtime, the CLR, when you build any one of those things, what you're actually building is what I call a type system. It is a way of expressing the constructs that programmers use to build APIs and then that other programmers use to consume those APIs. And that process But at the fundamentals, there's a type system. And every language has its own type system. The C language has its type system. The CLR has a type system. They all have a type system. It just describes how do you express the data, how do you express the patterns that we use.
Right.
And the Windows runtime is no different from any of the other platforms where we have ways of expressing that. And so one of the cool things with Windows runtime is that we said, at day zero, we said, what we're building is a cross-language runtime. The idea is that Windows developers author their APIs once, and then people build language projections on top of those APIs, and they express the concepts of the Windows runtime in a way that is natural and familiar. We said this a lot during the original bring up of Windows runtime. Natural and familiar. So what that means is, let me give a really simple example. The Windows runtime has a concept of an event.
Right.
And you can, you can, in a type, you can declare that there's a, that you have an event. Well, if you're a if you're a C# developer, when the C# equivalent of event is also called event, but when you look at an event and you use it, you say, and then you specify a delegate. That's a snippet of code,
right.
And so you say, you know, you use the plus equals operator. Well, if you're in JavaScript, though, what you end up doing is you say, the pattern for that is, the pattern is to say add event source on the function. I want to be able to express it. This is really the same concept, but
mm-hmm.
the syntax looks very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we express our concepts in a way that the language projection can do what they want to do and express it the way that doesn't feel awkward or weird to the developer who's using the language? And this is was literally our P0 requirement, was that whatever it is we produced had to be able to be set up in a way that the people who use the language projection can just simply make it work.
Or whoever's developing the actual APIs, they don't have to worry about it.
And they don't have to think
right?
about how it's expressed, because
right.
it's always done in a common way.
Right.
So we started with basically a green field. We had no preconceived notions. We knew that we wanted to support C++. We wanted to support C#. We wanted to support JavaScript. And through C#, we knew we wanted to be able to support the various CLR-based languages, so Visual Basic, F#, other languages
mm-hmm.
that are built on top of the CLR. So we knew we had that, and that was where we started from. These are the languages we're going to support. And since then, we've added Objective-C as a language projection. It turns out that the Unity API surface that the Unity team builds, they're not Microsoft, but it turns out they are actually using our same technology as part of their work. So it's grown well beyond the original scope. We have a new language projection for C++, which, unlike the previous C++ projection, the new projection is purely standards-based.
So the new one that just came out with the latest update.
With the latest update, the CPP WinRT.
Right.
Or C++/WinRT language projection. It's a brand new projection. It allows C++ developers to, well, instead of having to use platform colon string and all these funny hat characters
yeah.
that C++ CX used,
yeah.
this gives you the ability to do, to express using C. You use std string
right.
and you pass them into the APIs. And you can, the language projection builds a natural and familiar projection to C++ developers, and it's really quite lovely the way the code works. It's way better, it's simpler, it's easier to understand, frankly it's a joy to read, it's a joy to program in. So I mean, I major kudos to the C++ WinRT team, because they did a really good job on that language projection. Anyway, we have to be able to express our stuff to everything. So as I said, we went down to the ground principles. We said, okay, let's start talking about what does it mean to support, what do languages need? And we finally settled on the fact that we had to have, I believe it's 5 different base constructs.
Mm-hmm.
Base types, structures, enumerations, these are basically the 5 building blocks of the Windows runtime. And they each have their own set of purposes and values. They have a reason for existing. Base types, that's your bread and butter of any processor. structures, the ability to produce. I actually like the way that the ARM processor reference, it calls them aggregates. The idea is it's an aggregation of value types. So a structure is simply an ordered list of value types that are put together for useful constructs. So point and rect are sort of the canonical examples of structures. So we knew we needed to have structures. Enumerations, it turns out, are really, really, really useful constructs for, for choosing things, for picking things. One of my favorite APIs is the known files API, the known folders API. In the known folders API, one of the variants takes an enumeration to say which of the known folders do you want.
Photos or documents or whatever it is.
Yeah. Photos, documents, camera roll, multimedia playlists, whatever it is. There's an enumeration, and each of the enumeration are the things that can be retrieved from known folders. Classes are the bread and butter. Classes are what every developer thinks about, uses, and works with in the Windows runtime. This is what makes up the vast majority, because this is what developers like to think about. They think about classes. They think about types. And interfaces are a special case. A class describes a concrete implementation. Mm-hmm. This is a folder. This is a networking stream. This is an HTTP client instance. This is a URI. An interface is an abstract definition of a contract. It's a way of, it says, if this object implements this interface, then it has the following things in it.
Methods, properties,
events, and they are in a particular order. And the expectation is that you will re-implement. There's an expectation of reuse on interfaces.
You provide the actual implementation of that method.
Somebody else is going to provide the implementation, not necessarily the person who implemented the class. So somebody else is going to always implement an interface. There actually aren't that many public interfaces within the Windows Runtime API surface, simply because we don't actually need customers to implement a lot of objects. I just realized there's one I forgot. I am now an idiot, but whatever.
Delegates.
I always forget delegates. I don't know why, but I always do. Delegates are basically a callback. It's a lambda. If you're used to C++ or C#, as I said, they're lambdas. They're function objects in JavaScript. It's basically a way of saying, here's something you're going to call in a callback. And delegates are really, really, really important for the eventing pattern. It's not really possible to build the eventing pattern without delegates. A delegate is actually a very, very, very simple little interface. It's literally an interface with one method named invoke.
Oh, yeah.
That's actually how it's implemented under the covers. And how it's expressed in metadata. That's actually how you express it. It's actually a type that has a single method named invoke. As I said, so it's sort of a special case of an interface, if you will.
Right.
So these are where we started with. We said, okay, let's build these things. Let's build this type system. And then there's what are the details? Like, for instance, what's a base type? It turns out that's surprisingly hard to answer because everybody has their own idea. And we eventually settled on about 8 different base types. We have 32-bit signed and unsigned integers, 16-bit signed and unsigned integers. We have 8-bit signed integers, 8-bit unsigned integers, byte. We do not have 8-bit signed integers. So we don't support an 8-bit character type. And that was a conscious decision for, because our character type is a 16-bit character type. It's a Unicode character, a UCS2 character. We also support as our base types 64-bit integers, signed and unsigned, 32-bit floating point numbers, 64-bit floating point numbers, so floats and doubles, singles and doubles. We support strings, and we support GUIDs. we realized that the GUID type was sufficiently common in Windows programming. We do a lot of things that involve GUIDs. It's just part of the way we do our stuff. So we said, fine, we're going to make GUID, which is a 128-bit integer, effectively. Mm-hmm. We're going to make GUIDs, also a built-in type, a base type in the product. And so that was where we came up with our set of base types. They're all value types. So all of the base types, structures and enumerations, are value types. What that means is that you always deal with an instance of the object. It's a value. It's not a reference. It's not a pointer to something. It's an actual 32-bit integer. It's an actual 64-bit integer. Whatever it is, whatever the type is, you have a copy. Mm-hmm. Structures are aggregates for base types or for value types. So structures can contain enumerations, they can contain base types, and they can contain other structures.
Right. Kind of like wrappers around other wrappers. Around
exactly. Yeah. And in fact, so rect, I mentioned that earlier, rect is actually two points.
Right.
And a point is two floats, I believe, currently. We also, for a number of reasons, in Windows 8.1, I believe it was, we added the ability to put an optional struct field. So you could actually put a reference inside a struct, so you could actually have a struct member be an optional member. And that was needed for certain callbacks, which have value parameters. It was convenient for those callbacks to have the ability to say, oh, I'm not giving you this very large structure. There's a large structure that may or may not be available. So to reduce the size of the structure, they added this ability to have a reference in Windows 8.1.
It might be initialized eventually later on, right?
If you think about a progress, so this is specifically was added for the HTTP client APIs.
Oh.
I have an HTTP request outstanding, and the server's going to periodically send, you're going to get progress reports. Well, the progress report has a structure. That's the way it's defined, is that there's a callback, the progress event delegate has a structure associated with it.
Right.
At the last call of the progress, you're going to get the actual information about what you've retrieved. So you do a get, you get periodic callbacks with progress. Oh, I'm 10%, 20%, 30%. When you're done, you're going to get back a bunch of extra information about the state of the request. If it was an error, what was the error? What's the size of the data that's coming back, all sorts of other information. None of that is relevant until the last response. But it's always the same progress structure. So you don't want to provide this very large blob of data until the last call.
Right. Unless you can also provide different types of data, but you don't want to do that.
But the contract for progress only allows
this
a single
one type.
Anyway, so this is our base types, and then when we started looking at interfaces and classes, we said, okay, what goes into a class or an interface? And then, again, there's methods, there are properties, events. So those are the things that we made sure we had syntax for and that we provided mechanisms for in those. So you can now say that this class has these methods and these events and this stuff. And that's basically the Windows runtime from my standpoint. Other people, when they look at the Windows runtime, they see all the various different APIs and the networking, the security, the activation, all of these other things. When I look at the Windows runtime, this is the picture that I see. Because this is the world in which I live.
The building blocks.
The building blocks, because I live in the tooling.
I
live in the bowels of the type system. How is this stuff implemented? How is it expressed? How do you show this? And then how is it expressed in the various languages? What if I say this is an event, what does an event look like? The language experts will tell me what the pattern for the language is. We have to figure out and make sure that there's a compatible mapping between the two.
You can do the projections.
For the projections to be able to consume. And we wrap all of this stuff together and you author your types. We author our types in ITL. other people author their types in C#. Other people author their types in C++, CX. Mm-hmm. We author our types in a language called IDLE. It's been around for quite a long time. And from the IDLE files, we produce a WinMD file. And the WinMD file is the canonical definition of the type. So you have an IDLE file which describes all of the bits and pieces. The only thing that matters is that comes out of that is the WinMD file at the bottom. And that's what then gets handed off to the language projections. The language projections read the WinMD files, and then they know how to take the contents of that WinMD file, which is a binary file, mm-hmm. and then project that and produce the appropriate language concepts for the constructs.
It doesn't matter if it's JavaScript or C# or
Java or anything.
Yeah.
They all read that WinMD file. It happens to be an ECMA 335 metadata-only assembly. That's the technical details of the packaging file format, but it's just a description of the data for it. One of the nice things about producing WinMDs is that it allows the Windows team, because it's just binary data, it's regular, and I can now, and we have built tooling to sort, collate, combine the methods and types in a WinMD file in ways that are convenient for us to use. Mm-hmm. And we get all of that from the fact that we build these WinMD files and then can split them up and separate them up in ways that are useful and convenient. So.
That's
as I said, it's I live in the weeds. I live in the nerdy bottom end of everything.
Right.
And so it's a little bit, you know, I think about, as I said, type systems. What does it actually mean when I'm authoring these things?
So when developers are actually building their libraries or whatever it is, mm-hmm. What part of this do they actually need to know, and why is this relevant to them? Usually Visual Studio already does this, like does everything behind the scenes, creates the WinMDs for us.
Because this defines the this set defines the capabilities that you have available. A lot of languages support some capabilities that we don't have. Mm-hmm. For instance, the C++ has templates. The CLR has generics. Those allow you to expand type definitions with generic programming techniques. We don't. We have a closed set of what we call parameterized interfaces. And a parameterized interface is actually a way of describing an interface, where you can basically do substitution for individual parameters in the interface. But we have a fixed set of parameterized interfaces, and it is a closed set. You cannot define your own user-defined types. These restrict what you can do in your API implementation. When you're a developer building a Windows Runtime class, this limited set of parameterized interfaces actually matters to you, because if you start using constructs that cannot be expressed, the tooling will start failing because it can't be expressed
right.
in a way that the languages understand. And the languages rely on the fact that we have a fixed set of parameterized interfaces. And they know, for instance, the CLR knows that it should take an iVector parameterized interface and express that as a system array mm-hmm. specialized on that same type. So it knows to map from iVector to array. It knows the JavaScript similarly knows how to map from iVector to an array type in JavaScript. And all of the languages understand these built-in collections, these built-in types, so they can massage them appropriately to something that looks right for their language. Other things that we don't support, operator overloading. C++ and C# support operator overloads. JavaScript doesn't. So we can't support operator overloads we can't support them in the Windows runtime. So again, these are things that developers need to know, because if this is what you can do. And
right.
there are many times when there's other things you can do beyond what we support here, but if you don't understand these constraints, then you're gonna have failures at some point when you start stretching beyond what it is that the limited set of things that we allow you to do. I've talked about the type system. So way back, in the 1990s, when we first were coming up with RPC, the DCE Standards Committee defined a language for authoring interfaces, for authoring RPC interfaces. Mm-hmm. It was called IDL. I actually have, we were discussing a little earlier the books that Larry has on his shelf. One of the books on that top shelf is actually the RPC DCE, or at least the Microsoft the RPC Programmer's Guide and Reference for Win32. Sorry, is it good?
That's good.
Sorry, I wanted to make sure this was
actually. Yeah, yeah.
But this is actually the definition for, well, it contains our version of the DCE protocol for RPC.
This is amazing.
This described a language that we now call Middle One. And Middle One was used for RPC. COM, and it's been expanded a little bit over time, but that was basically the first edition of Middle, or the first version of Middle. If you find books on COM, they'll talk about the Middle One dialect. Mm-hmm. Now, Middle One is useful, but Middle One, at the end of the day, Middle One defines a dialect that is too restrictive for us to use for Windows runtime. Among other things, for instance, we knew when we were doing this that types, which have names, we didn't want a flat naming hierarchy. We wanted to have a hierarchy of names,
right,
which means we need to have something that resembles namespaces, or that would aggregate out as namespaces in the high-level languages. Now, for JavaScript, it's not namespaces. These are actually objects that have function, have object properties that happen to match the other names. So it's the Windows object with the foundation prop object on top of it as, sorry, foundation property, which points to another object,
okay, yeah,
which points to the whatever, and it just goes on and on and on. But it still feels like a namespace when you're
right,
a developer using it. In order to make that work, we came up with what we call Middle 2. Which was used for the Windows runtime. Now, Middle 2 is an interesting dialect. I designed it, but the best way I can describe it is it's special. I like to talk about things as being Baroque.
Baroque or
Baroque? Yes, exactly. Baroque or broke. I don't know. Probably a little bit of both, because, Baroque is a very ornate, decorative style. Mm-hmm. And broke also kind of applies. And I designed this, so I feel comfortable in, mm-hmm, in criticizing my own work. Turns out it's very hard to use Middle 2 as a language, because Middle 2 was designed around the implementation.
Okay.
So under the covers, I was mentioning classes. So under the covers, a class is actually implemented as a series of interfaces on top of a COM object. So when you say you have an object named foo, well, there's an ifoo interface that lives underneath that. And if when we version over time, and I didn't talk about versioning, but because it's out of scope for this, but when you version over time, you start with ifoo, then you add ifoo 2 and ifoo 3 and ifoo 4. So as each version, you add new interfaces to that class. Middle 2 required that you specify every single one of those interfaces separately. And then you'd author the class and you'd aggregate it on the class. And what that meant is that you'd start to figure out what a class did. You'd start at the class,
right,
and then you'd go look up there, then you'd look up there, then you'd look down there, then up there. Oh, wait, that's in another file. Oh, you have to go over here. It was very complicated to understand, and it was very hard to author and very hard to get right. A lot of constructs in the Middle 2 that caused significant confusion. A really simple example. We have properties in the Windows runtime. What is the name? When you look at it so let's talk about a property. So property named foo. At the implementation level, what that actually turns into, let's say this is read-write, it turns into two methods.
So a getter and a setter.
And then, yeah. It turns out, those get turned into two methods, get and set. But what's the name of that parameter?
Result. What?
Well, it would have been result, except I ran out of room on the whiteboard. But what's the name of that parameter? What's the name of this parameter?
Right.
Does it matter? Is this a result, or is this a value, mm-hmm. or is this something else?
Is it a pointer up there.
Well, it is, but what's the name? It turns out that when we were doing API reviews, when we were looking at APIs, it turns out people would spend hours arguing over what should be the name of this parameter. At the end of the day, there is exactly zero developers in the world who care about the name of that parameter. It doesn't matter. But we would be arguing about it because Middle 2 required that you specify hResult, foo, out, int. All of these things had to be specified. You had to write them all out because it was designed around the binary contract. It was designed around the low-level contract. And it meant that people had to spend time thinking about the low-level contract. And it turns out, people just want to write code. They just want to just write stuff down and just be done with it and move on with their life. And they want the tooling to do the work for them. They don't want to have to think about, I mean, they're probably going to have to think about this stuff when they go to implement the APIs, unless they're using C++ WinRT, in which case you don't. But they might have this is the area that they don't want to think about when they're designing the APIs, when they're thinking about the APIs.
Right.
So, starting about last year, around this time actually, we said, we can do better. We don't need all of this low-level goo when I actually want to write a type, when I want to define a type, when I want to define a class. What I want to do is, I just want to say, I just want to be able to write a class with a bunch of methods.
Right.
And if it has an event, or if it has a property, it's to define a read-write right. property or something natural.
Mm-hmm.
And again, natural and familiar. What do developers think about when they're writing classes? This is actually what they think about it because this is what their customers are going to use.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think about the low-level stuff. They don't think about where the return value goes, how you express the return value, all of those things. They don't care. They're irrelevant. And so that is where we come to where we are today with Middle 3. And when we were thinking about it, that was the working title we used when we were building this, was modern. I hate the word modern. It's been overused
right.
to death. But the idea here is to take all of the constructs that we had in Middle 2
mm-hmm.
and make them work better. Make the process of creating an API simpler for Windows developers and for external developers. So we started this effort, and it turns out, and I've been talking about C++ WinRT a lot,
right.
it turns out they have a problem. Because people want to be able to write APIs in C++ WinRT. And the C++ WinRT team has a mantra that says, were standards-based. It turns out the C++ standard doesn't have the bits and pieces that are necessary to build an authoring experience for types, a way of creating metadata from C++. Now, it turns out quite providentially, the standards committees have actually been working on this effort, and there are some proposals outstanding for how to solve this and ways that they can build the ability to author your types straight out of C++, but it's not available yet. It probably won't be available for several years, and of course, we have customers who want to be able to use this stuff. So the effort that I was driving combined or dovetailed very nicely with the effort that the C++ WinRT team was working on. And so the two of us joined forces conceptually and worked together to produce an interface, an authoring experience for both external developers who are using C++ WinRT and for our internal Windows team developers who are writing their APIs in, well, whatever it is they're writing their APIs in. And that was a lot, and that is the gist of what we now think of as Middle 3, which is our authoring experience moving forward for many years to come, I hope. So to give you an idea of what this looks like, this is the actual source code to, sorry, the actual definition for Windows Foundation URI,
right,
which is, I like this API, it's one of my canonical APIs. That's what it looks like. And there's a lot of microtyping on here. It's tiny. And the reason it's tiny is because there's a lot of goo that frankly nobody cares about. So what does this thing look like when we convert it to Middle 3? That's the exact same API. The exact same APIs.
So much less.
When you express it in Middle 3.
Right.
It's now all of a sudden shrunk to a single page, single column that's much larger, and there's a ton of noise that was just removed when we moved to Middle 3. And that's why we did this. Because now I can, this is what I want to think about.
This is readable by anybody now.
Exactly.
Right? Anybody can just write this.
They can write this, they can use this, they can read this. I cannot tell you how many people have come and said, why didn't you do this 5 years ago? Why have you spent all this time making me use this horrible, horrible, horrible syntax
right.
when you could have done this? And frankly, I agree with them.
I don't have a good answer for that.
I don't have a good answer for that. What's also cool, and this doesn't matter for external developers,
right.
but it does for Windows internal developers, is what happens when I start thinking about how I extend this over time. There's a teeny bit of a cheat going on here. The URI class has actually changed over time,
okay.
and I didn't describe how the versioning works in either the Middle 2 or the Middle 3 version of it. But how versioning works, it turns out, is really, well, I hesitate that we use the word, but frankly, it works. Lovely. Sorry, it's true. I'm really happy. It's actually what I'm most happy about is how we change types over time and how that works with this. And I can show on the whiteboard what this looks like.
Sure, yeah, absolutely. When you mean versioning over time, you mean every time we have a new update to the platform, right? When we go from, was it 1.7.1.3.4 to the next version, it's going to be a new version.
In my world, I don't think about that.
No.
In my world, I think about how the type system
mm-hmm.
and how the types change over time. Now, it may be that, and in fact, in recent history, types have versioned on platform release boundaries. There's nothing that actually requires that.
Right.
In the model, we could actually rev the types if we were to ship updates or if we were to iterate more rapidly, we could ship things more rapid cadence, slower cadence. The type system supports
all of that. You're not limited by the type system.
The type system supports all that. So from one version of Windows to the next. So, as I said, unfortunately, I don't have any good examples in the slide deck to show how that works, but I do have some examples I can write on the whiteboard to show this very quickly.
Move this over there, too.
Let's say I have a type. I'll use the example I have there. So, first thing to keep in mind is when we take, when we do versioning, when we think about versioning, we think about types as being in what we call an API contract, which is a collection of APIs. The most common one that people will see in our headers and our metadata is the Universal API contract. That is the set of APIs that are available on every edition of Windows regardless. Mm-hmm. So, in this case, I'm just using some abbreviations because I don't like typing or drawing, writing. So this type was introduced in version 1 of the Universal API Platform contract. Let's say and then all the various methods. Now, we're now doing the Spring Creators, or sorry, the April update, the April 2018 update. So how do I express that I'm going to add some new APIs to URI, or new methods to URI?
So you're doing it in line.
Do it in line. Yeah, you do it in line. Now, if you look at the old version, this was actually, you had to look in two different places to figure out how to stitch all the pieces together. It's just in line. You say, oh, here's the next version, and here are the methods from the next version. And here's the methods from the next version, and the next version. So as we look at it over time, I have all that data right here available in my face, in one place. One of the other things that I didn't talk about, remember I mentioned how runtime classes are all built from interfaces, that there are actually COM interfaces that implement this. One of the things about interfaces is that interfaces have an ID, an IID, an interface ID. You will notice that I didn't write any interface IDs.
There's no GUIDs anywhere.
There's no GUIDs anywhere here. And the reason for that?
Yeah.
I synthesized that. The middle will now synthesize the GUIDs for you.
Create everything for you. The interface,
it creates the interface name. So this is going to create IURI as the interface name by default.
Right.
And then it'll have the methods, and that'll be IURI. And it'll have an IID, and the IID is based on the method signature, on the shape of the API that you defined. You add a new version. When you use these braces, we say, oh, that's a new version. It's got a new version number. That's going to become IURI2. And again, I have a shape of methods that are there. I'll build you an interface ID for that based on the shape of the methods, that are the shape of the API, the name of the API, things like that, all the things that put together. I'll give you a name. You can also specify the name if you want to.
Okay.
There's an interface name attribute you can add, which says, I want you to use this name for the interface. You can also say, I want you to use this name and this GUID. That's really useful for our purposes when we want to convert an older class to a newer class, to the new format, from middle 2 to middle 3. Part of my test collateral for this code actually converts every Windows Runtime metadata file into a middle 3 equivalent with all of the versioning information, etc.
From the previous version,
and then verifies to make sure that when you compile the new file, that it A, compiles, and B, produces the identical metadata from the original, because that's, I couldn't feel safe and comfortable saying that this was complete until I had verified that everything in the Windows Runtime that we had today was actually, could be expressed using the new syntax. And I'm really glad I did that exercise, because there's a lot of corner cases that I didn't realize existed that people had used. Just things that, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but for instance, there was a team that added a method overload to a constructor.
Okay.
Constructors all have the same name, .ctor.
Right.
They don't have, they're inherently overloaded. That's part of the pattern. But this team had added an overload attribute. So I had to come up with a way of a mechanism to let them do what they used to do. It's the kind of thing that I had to do. There are a lot of very obscure and unusual syntax elements that were in the old, mm-hmm. that people were able to use. So it was an incredibly valuable exercise to go run through that. But when I was done, I was completely confident that I was going to be able to let this out and let customers and Windows developers use this, because I knew that anything that they'd thrown at it before, if it worked before, it still works.
Right, so there's no breaking changes.
Hmm.
Right.
Actually, technically there have been some breaking changes. Remember my comment about the parameter names?
Right.
When I talked about parameter names earlier? Well, one of the things that happens when you have, erase the property example, when that property does, there's no parameter names there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reason that there's no parameter names is because there's no parameter.
You don't have to worry about it.
So I synthesize them. Well, not everybody followed the API coding guidelines with respect to parameter names for return values and for property getters and setters and event adders and removers. And so there were some breaking changes. None of them matter. And we have reports. Whenever somebody makes a change that breaks our API surface or potentially breaks our API surface, we actually have reports that come out from our automated tooling.
Right.
So when we started converting things over, we've been looking very carefully at those reports, making sure that the changes that we're bringing up are not breaking changes. One thing that we found recently that turns out to have been a breaking change, you notice that the syntax here for methods has string new method.
Right.
Well, at the binary level, again, this is think ahead.
Wow.
Well, this is okay. The issue here is that there's a return value parameter. It's always the last parameter. It always has out and red val, and it has a parameter name. I synthesize the parameter name based on our API coding guidelines,
mm-hmm.
which in this case I think is result. That's the standardized name. Well, it turns out that if you have a method that has multiple out parameters, any method with multiple out parameters when it is projected to JavaScript is actually projected, the return value is actually projected as a structure. As an object with properties whose names match the out parameters.
Right.
When I changed the name of the return value, I introduced a breaking from whatever it was the developer put in a method that has multiple out parameters.
Mm-hmm.
When I changed that name, I introduced a breaking change to our APIs.
For JavaScript.
For JavaScript
right.
customers.
Right.
But this was a breaking change.
Right.
So I had to fix it. So there's now a mechanism that I built in that if you need to be compatible with the name of the return code, you can specify the return name, the name of the return value for the method. Because we're not about to break the API. We are not, it would be a failure in this, middle three would be a failure as far as I'm concerned, if we could not fully express every existing ETL file with full fidelity.
Right.
So that is fundamental, because if we can't say and do everything we used to do, then
right.
what was the point?
Yeah, why are you creating a new thing when you can't do the same?
If you can't do the same things
yeah.
you could do before,
right?
Well,
this is awesome.
So anyway, but that's like this has been my life for the past year. It's been building this. It's been an interesting experience, actually. It's been an interesting experiment because the middle code base is, the earliest record I have is from 1993. There, so it's
25 years.
25
ago?
Years ago, yeah. So it's a 25-year-old code base.
Right.
It was never designed to do any of these things that I have done, and so there has been a wonderful experience figuring out how to make all this work.
Right.
It's been a thrill, actually. But this, and I cannot say how proud I am of this work, because it's just, sorry, I'm touting my own horn.
No, that's
I think it actually is giving value. It helps customers, it helps our developers inside Microsoft and outside Microsoft. Because now, if I'm a C++ WinRT type or C++ WinRT developer, I could start writing types that look natural and familiar, that feel right, that are easy to use. There's a ton of external developer feature customers, external customer features in here that you don't necessarily even, I haven't even talked about, that have to do with how you write an author's XAML types. So the experience for authoring a XAML type, we have some, we went to a great deal of effort to make sure that you could write classes to be consumed by XAML very straightforward, in a very straightforward manner. So that you could write XAML controls using the new syntax, and it wasn't hard. It wasn't painful to do.
And familiar.
Yeah,
right. So what's next? What's next for you?
What's next for me?
Or what's next for middle, or what's next for...
For middle, honestly, we don't know. I literally don't know. I have a backlog of features that people have been asking for, and I don't know what we're going to end up doing for those features moving forward. I know there have been a lot of things proposed. Some of them are kind of challenging, because to implement some significant new features, and as I said, we have a long list, it requires a great deal of coordination, because it's not okay to just produce something that only works in C++ WinRT, but doesn't work in C#,
right,
or JavaScript, or Objective-C, or whatever else it is that we're producing. If we start adding significant new features, then there's going to be some challenges with respect to how we deploy them out over time. So I honestly don't know the answer to what's next. I wish I did. Magic 8-Ball somewhere?
Right.
I've got so much junk in this office, surely I have a Magic 8-Ball here
something
somewhere.
Something tells where we're going.
Yeah, but unfortunately I don't have one, so I can't actually answer that question, unfortunately.
Well, you've answered so many questions today, I think we got enough.
Okay,
Well, thank you so much.
Not a problem.
If developers have any questions, can they find you somewhere online?
I'm Osterman on Twitter.
Awesome.
I'm Osterman on Twitter, and... also, if you leave a note on the Channeline forums, I look at them periodically. So that's it. Twitter's probably the fastest, because I'm a little bit obsessive about reading Twitter. I spend way too much time on that, and I probably shouldn't. But
who isn't?
Yes, exactly. I'm also on GitHub. I'm on a bunch of other areas. Unfortunately, I don't check them as frequently.
Right.
So Twitter is actually probably your best bet.
Yeah, I think most developers will find you on Twitter. If not, we'll guide them to you.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks.